Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It began as a Christmas gift to his children. It became a number one New York Times bestseller with more than 20 million copies sold and a Hollywood movie starring Octavia Spencer and Sam Worthington. William Paul Young never intended to be famous. When his first book, The Shack, swept the bestseller lists, he became one of the best-known authors of our time. His books also include Eve, Crossroads, and Lies We Believe About God. He's coming to Sioux Falls for the South Dakota Faith in Public Life event. You can see him at the Sioux Falls Convention Center on October 2nd. That's this coming Monday night. But first, he joins us now from Portland, Oregon. William Paul Young, welcome.
Oh, so good to be with you. I'm a huge fan of National Public Broadcasting, so it's an honor to be with you.
Thank you. We appreciate your time. I spoke a little bit about the origins of this book and how you wrote it for your family, first and foremost. I'm wondering if it was easier in some ways to not think about how people would react outside your own family. When you were writing it, did that give you the freedom to really just say what you wanted to say without considering pushback or other opinions?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and not that I've really been concerned about that sort of thing. I've sort of been a little bit of an outlier most of my life. I grew up as a missionary kid in the highlands of New Guinea. So it's not exactly your normal history. And questions have always been great companions for me. So without intending to, I've always kind of pushed the edges a bit. And so when I wrote this, the only goal I had in mind was to get it done for Christmas because Kim, who I'm married to, had been saying for about 4 years, you know, someday as a gift for our kids, would you just put something in one place that puts how you think because you think outside the box. And by the way, when it actually got put into print, she said, you know, when I asked you to do this, I was thinking like 4 to 6 pages. But yes, it does clear the space. And you know what? I continue to write for friends and family. And I'm thrilled how many people have been able to read over their shoulders, as it were, and that I've been able to participate in unbelievable stories. I think that's the holy ground, the other people's stories.
When you wrote the following books, the other books on your, Eve and Crossroads, did you think more? Was it a different process? Did you think more about, will this be published? How will it be received? Will it sell like The Shack?
No. You know, those kinds of questions, they've just not been part of the way that I relate to my life anymore. It took me 50 years to finally become a child, and so I just decided I'm not going back to being an adult. That kind of stuff just is too much work. And it was kind of strange to be then in a contract to write a second novel, and that was Crossroads, and then go like, oh my gosh, I'm actually writing a book on purpose. And but the flow of Crossroads was almost identical to The Shack. Eve was a lot harder because Eve, I'm trying to put 40 years of scholastic work that I've done on the issue of women primarily, which frankly is what led me into the whole conversation about the Trinity. And but so I'm trying to put 40 plus years of scholarship into a work of fiction accessible to a teenager. That was a challenge and a little bit of a different writing process. But I've never really written it for anybody but the one, you know, that one person that this would touch. And I always start with my family.
I'm curious to know why it took you 50 years to have a childhood.
Oh, you know, a lot of us grow up inside of a world that is fundamentally broken. The Shack represents the house on the inside that people help you build. And there's a bunch of us that we didn't get good help. And even though I grew up in a very religious environment, or maybe especially because I grew up in a very religious environment, I had a lot of baggage that I had to work through. Part of that was a very difficult relationship to my dad, who just didn't have a chip for being a dad. His father had broken that before I showed up. And you know, children, they don't understand that their parents aren't perfect. And so everything that goes wrong, all the fury and the anger, has got to be their fault. And so that was part of my great sadness. And then inside the tribal culture that I grew up and then in boarding school, there was a significant amount of sexual abuse. And that will tear the childhood out of the soul of the human being quicker than anything that I know of on this planet. And so, you know, you learn to survive. Your survival skills become impediments to relationships, but you're always about trying to stay safe. You don't trust anybody. You don't trust God. You know, your view of God is all messed up. And it took 50 years of work. It took 50 years before I finally became a child, in the sense that I'm comfortable in my own skin. I am content within the world that I'm inside of, even the really hard stuff. I've learned to live inside the grace of the day, which children do naturally. I've learned to trust, which also children do naturally until someone teaches them that it's dangerous. So all of those factors have gone into, you know, when people ask me, how long did it take you to write The Shack? I tell them 50 years, you know. Then I tell them 6 months because I was working 3 jobs. But I never took the course, so I didn't know that was too fast.
Right. Was there an epiphany, or was it just the deadline? Was it the deadline and Kim's encouragement that said, what made
no
the
deadline.
Age of 50? Yeah. Well,
yeah.
She
no,
said by no. Christmas you want the story. I mean that deadline.
Well, no. She'd been saying that for 4 years. So there was,
oh, okay.
There was no particular deadline, except that was a year we had nothing. And I had nothing to give the kids for Christmas. And the year I finally felt healthy enough to do this, to write something as a gift for the kids. So at Christmas, went down and made 15 copies at Office Depot that did everything I ever wanted that book to do. So there was no sense of pressure or deadline, except that I wanted to be able to give this to my children for Christmas. And they were, the youngest at the time was 13, and we have 6 kids, so 13 to 26 at the time.
Why do you think the book, The Shack, let's start there, why do you think people clung to it so ardently, where people were, you know, getting one copy and then ordering a case? What was it that you think really made that happen?
I think it's a very human story. It asks really good human questions. I don't think there's any greater loss that human beings can experience than the loss between a parent and a child. I think that goes to the deepest core of where we feel there's injustice or our questions rise. And that kind of loss, I think, raises the best questions. So it's framed within a really authentic journey. And it doesn't have the hooky, religious, you know, quick, simple answers. It allows us to both experience the loss and then to grapple with the questions that it raises in such a way that people all over the world identified with it, in every culture, in every religious frame of reference or non-religious frame of reference. And I think it's just the humanity of it. Nobody saw it coming, and I certainly didn't. But for it to do this to me has been a real kindness. It has transcended pretty much every barrier you can imagine. It's in death row. It's in psychiatric hospitals. It's in palaces, and it's in temples and seminaries. It's just found a way to give people a language to have a conversation about God and loss that is not religious, and yet really centered on some of the deepest questions of our humanity, including our spirituality.
There's a moment where the main character, Mac, is driving toward the shack, and you say he's really driving into the vortex of his own pain. Why do you think it's important to sort of head toward pain or suffering instead of trying to escape it?
I'm going to quote Brené Brown on this, because I think she's one of the most fantastic voices on the planet right now. And she has a couplet that I really love, and it goes something like this, that if you don't own your own story, it will own you. And the second part is, but if you own your own story, you have the authority to write the ending. And I love that couplet. A lot of us spend our whole lives running away from the places we're broken, You know, we create a facade outside the shack that we can paint as fast as we can pick up people's expectations, to use the metaphor. And our journey toward wholeness has got to go back into our own souls. We have to deal with what's broken there, because you can't share with anyone what you don't possess yourself. And a lot of us, because shame has been the dominating motivator of our lives, we've got to go back to the places that triggered it or caused it, or, you know, not only what was done to us, but then what we did in our response and turned around and perpetrated ourselves. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to move toward wholeness, you got to go back into the darkness. There's just no way, and find out that the light of healing and wholeness and the presence of God and all that is inside the shack, because that's our own soul.
Have you read her latest book, Brené Brown's?
Oh, yes, Braving the Wilderness. I recommend it without any restrictions. You know, if you got mm-hmm. a little bit of a sensitivity to her language sometime, which I don't. I worked in the oil field, so she's just this tough Texan person who loves Jesus and loves humanity and is a really great researcher, social researcher, who knows how to put all that into a package and deliver it with authenticity. So no hesitation to promote Braving the Wilderness. I think every human being should read it.
And it's interesting, because I was listening to her book on audio in a long drive across the state this weekend, and then I came back and read The Shack. And so it's amazing how much those two books really complement each other, with the nonfiction social research and then this, this allegory or this fiction story.
That
they pair well together.
They do. And funny, I just read it. We listened to it. My daughter, Amy, who is moving down to L.A. to finish up a degree in sonogram technology. So about 2 weeks ago, we drove from the Portland, Oregon area down to L.A. listening to Braving the Wilderness.
So. Yeah. Why was it important to show God in relationship? One of the first moments when Mac enters the shack, he noticed this is how these characters, these people, these, visions
three,
that he's
three
seen.
Three persons.
Yeah. It's hard to get language around the Trinity, isn't it?
Yes.
But he immediately notices, well, this is not how we treat each other. So how important was it for you to have those scenes where these three characters interacted so specifically?
Essentially important, because I think that religion, for all the beautiful stuff that it's participated on the planet, creating sacred space and great art and music, and really a lot of religion has reached out to try to help us in our human brokenness. But a lot of our fundamental religious perspectives, I think, are flawed, because religion oftentimes starts with a singular God of some sort, some deity who is alone and then creates. And frankly, if a God has ever been alone, that God does not by nature love. And I think the most fundamental truth that we as human beings and inside this creation, we know to the core of our being, that love and relationship matters. It's our brokenness is connected to how disassociated we are from the truth that that other-centered, self-giving love is at the core. So if you have a God in which there is no other-centered, self-giving love, this God is alone, then you've got the basis for religion that climbs into that space and says, you're separated, and therefore here are the things and the hoops you have to jump through in order to get unseparated. So to me, the whole vision of the Trinity is not just a metaphoric idea, but a reality that there has to be a significant ontological truth with regard to it, that God is not just alone. And so the three persons face-to-face-to-face that is presented in the Jewish world and the Christian world that moved out of it, and there are senses of that throughout religions around the world, but that gives you a basis for both love and relationship. And that means that relationship is at the core of not only the nature of God, but the nature of what it means to be human. That's why love is the big deal. And until, we get our arms around some of this, we're just going to continue the kinds of political rhetoric and economic rhetoric and all this. We're going to treat people as territory and property and on and on and on inside of all of our divisions, rather than say, you know what, we're made in the image and likeness of a God who's never been alone. And this is about community and relationship and love. So it was critical for me in terms of communicating to my children. You have to always remember, I didn't write this for the world. They just showed up. And it was God's great sense of humor. But it is absolutely essential that we get to watch a relationship that is within the very being of God. And it resonates with people. It just did all around the world in every culture and religious frame of reference. And everybody wanted to be inside Papa's embrace. Yeah. Even if then their religious sensibilities then reacted, you know, my people tend to be a little bit, my people are modern evangelical Protestant fundamentalists. And so, you know, my people, we're too scared a lot of times to take the risk of relationship. So it's all about being right. But we're working on it. And we're kind of our loving each other forward in this really difficult process of extricating ourselves from being addicted to certainty rather than the mystery of relationship.
It is so hard for Mac to get past that because he wants the rules. He wants to somehow be able to check his list, you know, for goodness, and there's issues of judgment. What's the role of trust in your life? You put down this book. It's all about trust. That's what Mac is really struggling with. That's what so many of us are struggling with. Talk about trust.
It is the single biggest movement in my life. Everything. If you took my life and drew the golden thread, it would be about moving away from shame and the control that it brings toward trust. When we have fear in our lives, and this is right out of 1 John in the New Testament, it says basically that to the degree that fear dominates our lives, to that degree we don't know yet how much we're loved. And because perfect love casts out fear, and the one who fears is not perfected in love, and there is no fear in love. So when you face fear, you've got one of two choices. You either trust or control. And we live in a broken world, and if trust has been broken in us even as children, that's a big journey to take that risk. And yet, that's where life happens. And so then the questions arise in terms of spirituality is like, so is God good all the time? Because frankly, you're not going to trust a God who's not. And a lot of our theology has not presented to us a God who is good all the time. That's, to me personally, that's where I think Jesus is the centerpiece, because he is the revelation of a God who's good all the time. And he's fully human, fully divine, fully human. And he functions in a broken world in a way in which love is incarnate, and you get to see it. But in our own journeys, man, the taking the risk of trust as opposed to being control freaks, I'm a control freak because I don't trust anybody. That's my history. And my whole journey was moving incrementally and slowly into taking the risks of trust and then being willing to embrace the consequences of those risks. So my whole life centered around the issue of trust and the eradication of shame.
If you're just tuning in, my guest, author William Paul Young, he wrote The Shack, Eve, other titles. He's coming to Sioux Falls. And I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier in our conversation about the stories of how this book has impacted people's lives. I'm wondering if you can think of a story to share with us to sort of see how these ripples have gone outwards.
Oh my gosh. There are thousands of them. And so I'll give you one. I meet a couple, and I do book signings, which is really an odd thing to me. So I hug everybody because that's the only way I think you can redeem a book signing. And so you'll never see me behind the table or anything. It's just like, oh, no. Plus, I didn't take the class, so I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And but they start laying down pictures, photographs on the table, and it turns out that about a year and a half before I meet them, their early 20s daughter was killed in a in a drunk driver incident, the driver's, you know, hit and run, and an only child. So it was absolutely devastating. And they spiraled down into this great sadness. And for about 8 months, every time, especially the mom, every time she would try to climb her way out of the hole, something would trigger it, and down she'd go again. And then 8 months into this, her husband says to her, kind of out of desperation, you know, we need to change our scenery. We need to do something that breaks the cycle. And so there's two states we've never visited that are right next to us. Why don't we take a road trip for 2 weeks and just go explore? And we'll just drive, find a bed and breakfast, and then just drive around and look at things just to change what we're looking at every day. And surprisingly, she agreed because she was very lost in a pretty deep depression. So they went driving, and about 10 days into their trip, they were two states away, area that they'd never been before, farmland, rolling hills kind of thing. Stayed in a little town. In the morning, they got up, and they said, well, you know, why don't we put together a breakfast, find a little picnic table somewhere, and have a breakfast. And so they decided to do that. Well, they started looking for a park that would have a picnic bench so that they could have their picnic lunch, and they couldn't find one. And they started doing these concentric circles looking for this thing. And they couldn't find a park. They're like, how weird is this? Every town has a park. And they start driving further and further out. And about an hour and a half into this, they're about ready to give up. And the wife says, hey, let's take this road. It was a paved road, and they took it 6 or 7 miles into the countryside. And then she says, hey, let's try that one, which was a dirt road. So now they're on a dirt road. Who knows where they are, but there's no houses. There's big fields with fencing around it, and, you know, rows of trees, windbreaks and stuff in the back. And they're driving along, and she says, look. And off to one side, there's this big mowed field with a picnic table in the middle of it. And it's like in the middle of nowhere. So, and they've got pictures of this, right? So they're laying these down, these pictures. So they walk over, and it turns out not to be a picnic table. It turns out to be an old porch that used to belong to some homestead that used to be there that has burned down and been torn down or taken away. Mm-hmm. The only thing left was this stone and concrete steps going up to this porch. And, I mean, but there's nobody around, so they're going like, well, we'll do this. They laid their little plastic tablecloth there and put out their food. And as they're eating, the wife is looking at the far fence about 50 yards away, and she says, look, there's a little outbuilding over there, and there's some sign right above it. Can you see what it says? And he looks, and he goes, nah, so far away, and looks at her and says, I'll go look. So he walks over to this little like shed, and he's got a picture of it, and above the door is this oval sign that simply says The Shack. which means nothing to him at this time. He never heard of the book or anything. So he comes back and he says, it just says The Shack, which is okay. Well, they finish eating and they start walking back to their car. And the wife says, turns around and starts heading back and says, I'm going in there. And he's confused, like, you're going in where? She says, I'm going in that little, The Shack. I'm going in The Shack. And he's like, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, you just don't, somebody might be sleeping in there and you just don't want to wake him up suddenly. She said, I'm going in. You can go to the car or whatever. So he follows her over. She walks right in. And in this little it's just a tiny little room with four walls. And on one wall, and they've got pictures of everything. On one wall, there is a table. And on the table, there is a sign-up sheet and a little notice and two copies of a book she'd never seen. And the notice said, please take whatever you need. And she looks, and the sign-up has been signed by people from different states. And she stands in front of me, tears running down her face, and she raises up this battered copy of The Shack, and she says, your book saved my life. Somebody had been touched by reading the shack and have been nudged to set up a little place out in the middle of nowhere to give away copies of the shack. And this couple had traveled two states to find it.
Wow.
And it had intersected them and pulled them out of the dark hole that they had been in.
Oh, wow.
And, that's a story, right?
It's a story.
It's a story. And human beings are stories.
Is a good
that's
one.
Part of the beauty. Yep.
Yeah.
So when I come to Sioux Falls, we'll tell stories because I'm a storyteller and I've got lots of great stories that have been around this whole thing.
Mm. William Paul Young comes to Sioux Falls for the South Dakota Faith in Public Life event. You can see him at the Sioux Falls Convention Center. That's October 2nd. It's a free will offering open to the public. Author of The Shack, Eve, Crossroads, and Lies We Believe About God. William Paul Young, thank you so much for your time today.
I am so honored. Blessings on your day. Love South Dakota. See you soon.